Hey, this is The Takeaway, and we've got four stories that you definitely need to hear today. Plus, we've got indie rockers Yola Tango on the end of the podcast, so you'll definitely want to stick around. And this is The Takeaway for March 16th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Think about a time when you were a kid when you did something bad. And I don't mean drawing on the walls with crayons. I mean a time you did something stupid, even maybe illegal. You probably knew it was wrong. Maybe you didn't at the time. Maybe you were a good kid and it was just something you did in the moment. The truth is, a lot of young people make bad choices. But the outcomes for kids, the consequences, that's where paths can diverge.
I tried to outrun a cop on my mini bike, and he caught me. So I had to go to juvenile hall and appear before a judge and everything. It was a bad thing to do.
I never faced any consequences for cutting class because I was in honors classes and got good grades. And even at that young age, I was appalled by the inequality of enforcement.
The police started to follow me. I panicked. I took off and ended up totaling the car in a ditch. They arrested me, and the judge said to my father, "Is he a good kid?" My father said, "Yes." And they let me go with just a speeding ticket. If I had not been white at that time, my whole life would have been ruined by that event.
What happens when kids, impulsive by their very nature, commit crimes? This week, WNYC Studios kicked off a 9-part podcast looking at America's juvenile justice system, how and why some kids get caught up in it, and what it means to get labeled an offender. Around 50,000 teenagers are held at some kind of juvenile facility on any given day in this country. A lot of them are kids like Z, who isn't using his real name since he's under 18.
Every day I wake up, every time I go to sleep, I think about being locked up. I be having dreams.
The podcast is called Caught, and with me now is contributor Dwayne Betts, a poet and Yale Law School graduate who spent 9 years in prison for a crime he committed at 16. He's on the podcast. And here's Kai Wright, host of Caught from WNYC Studios.
We're really primarily taking listeners into the lives of the sorts of young people who end up in the juvenile justice system. So often when we talk about criminal justice, period, we don't talk to people who are actually experiencing the problem. We talk about them. We don't hear from them. And we reduce them to their crimes. We reduce them to the things they're at risk for. And so what we're doing in this series is backing up from that and really meeting these young people, hearing their stories from them, and learning that it's much more complicated when we think about what their problems are and what they need.
I get locked up and I'm doing time. And I remember standing in front of the judge and seeing everybody inside the courtroom. And I just picture myself being remanded. They putting those tight handcuffs on me and bring me to the back room and lock me in the cell.
How often do you have these thoughts?
Every day. Every day I wake up.
Now, we should say, though, this isn't about guilt or innocence. This isn't about taking a juvenile offender and saying, oh, they're not culpable because they were 16. It's not really about that at all.
That's right. No, I mean, everybody in this podcast has been convicted of a crime. Whether or not they committed the crime is not the debate. The question that we're pursuing is, okay, so now what? So we have decided that a 12-year-old is guilty of a crime. What do we do with that in society? And is what we're doing currently, which is just punish them with more and more intensity, is that appropriate?
Dwayne, you are one of the lives that Kai is talking about. You're not a subject of this series, but you're part of it. You spent 9 years in prison for a carjacking when you were just 16 years old. Can you tell a little bit of that story, what led up to it, and what came afterward for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, and this is probably the tragic truth and probably the tragedy of the whole series, is that the story is a short one. I mean, it took 30 seconds for me to pull out a gun and rob somebody. I got picked up the next day. I pled guilty, and I found myself at 16 facing life in prison. And I think that the key, though, is that if you choose to describe me as an offender, if you choose to describe me as the kid who carjacked somebody, what you do isn't focusing on just guilt. You, like, block out all sense of potential. And though I faced life in prison, the judge knew, and probably the prosecutor and my attorney, they knew from the start that I wouldn't get life. And my judge, he said, I'm under no illusion that sending you to prison will help. Then he sentenced me to 9 years. And again, his sentence was based on this urgent need to punish, excluding all else, and exclude even a cognizance of, like, what might happen to a young person in prison. And so, you know, that whole situation let me know that whatever potential, whatever light might be on the end of the tunnel was for me to discover, because nobody in the room that day imagined me to make it where I am now, except my family.
Now, at the time of this crime, though, Duane, right, you were in the Honor Society.
Yeah.
I mean, was any of this part of the court's evaluation of you or the judge's evaluation of you? Did any of this enter into how the judge or the system, I'll say, thought about you as an offender?
The strange thing is I got incarcerated when I was in 11th grade. I ended up graduating from high school when I was 16 because I had enough credits to graduate early. So I tell people I skipped the 12th grade and went to prison. and you know, but the joke of it is that that didn't matter to the prosecutor. It didn't matter to the judge. We didn't have a system, really, that allowed them to care about those things. And so I don't even want to act as if they were the problem. We literally did not have a system that allowed them to ask those kinds of questions. We didn't have. I remember my first attorney, the one that my mother fired, told her that I would be lucky if I could get into community college. Now I got a degree from the best law school in the world. And we still don't really have a system that fundamentally imagines me to be possible.
And I think what's interesting is that, you know, Duane talks about this in the podcast, is that we look at Duane's stories like that, and we like to say, oh, look at the reform that's possible. Look at all that he has done for himself. And it's a feel-good story of somebody who redeemed himself. And I think it's important to stop and turn that around and look at it the other way. You know, is it, yeah, sure, Duane has done amazing things with his life, but the real question is, why didn't the system see that in the first place? You know, why did it have to be in spite of the system?
I was going to say not because of, but in spite of.
Right.
I think, honestly, the fundamental problem is that we, once you get put in a certain box, we are unable to think about you outside of that box. And so that box starts with, like, you committed a crime, and we like to think that it's just the murder, the body in the street. But I think what court shows is that that same type of mentality starts with being accused of shoplifting. It starts with a fight in sixth grade, like the same mentality, the same putting a young person in that box, and typically a young person of color in that box. It starts so young that it becomes almost an inescapable trap for a lot of people.
Today is April 1st. I've been here at least a month, transferring from different facilities. I've been to juvenile centers. I've been to Rikers.
Picture somebody constantly poking you. You holding all your energy inside, not speaking to nobody. Sooner or later, you're just going to burst.
Now, Kai, you have Duane along with you to tell these stories, but tell me a little bit about Z's story, because he is the young man, the juvenile, whose interaction with the system didn't start at 16 or 15, I think 11 or 12.
Yeah, the first time he had handcuffs on him was for truancy at the age of 12, and the first time he found himself in lockup waiting to see a judge was at 13. And that was literally for a schoolyard fight. That was literally because he got into a fight on a schoolyard, and his school is next door to a police precinct in a neighborhood that is labeled as a place with high crime. And so it has a zero tolerance policing attitude. And when the kid he got in a fight with, instead of going to the principal's office, went to the police station, they arrested him and treated him like a hardened criminal. And that was the beginning of his saga. So there's that part of it, which is like we can see the way in which this really aggressive zero tolerance attitude, both in terms of school discipline, it's true in our schools, and in terms of policing in our neighborhoods, which is so often directed at young men of color. But the other part of Z's story that I think is interesting is that no one's acting like Z was okay. Z, like many of us in our childhood and in our adolescence, needed help. He had issues. He had some mental health challenges, not profound ones, but real ones, and he needed help. And in the times in his life when he was getting that help, he was excelling. And when he didn't get that help, his life would get more complicated. And what is, I think, probably most tragic about his story is that when he really got the most help was only once he was inside the criminal justice system. That's the only time when he finally could get the help he truly needed. And that is a perversity, you know, because now the help comes with punishment and with a label that is forever going to define him.
It's important to note, though, that the point is not that we should see the young person as possibly committing a serious crime, but what we should see them as is somebody who is profoundly calling out for help and imagine what that help should look like outside of the punitive model that we only use. I mean, I spent nearly 6 years in prison before I talked to a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Well, Duane, I wanted to ask you about that once you went into prison at 16 years old, whether there was anything in place for you to help change your direction. Now, you say it took 6 years before a mental health professional talked to you. And in the interim, were you like any other inmate? Were you on a path to be in and out of prison, do you think, for a very long time?
2 points. Again, like I pushed back against the kind of language that we use that frames people as like inmates, convicts, prisoners. And I pushed back because, you know, right after graduating from Yale Law School, I had a spate of stories about me, and every story needed to say ex-con graduates from Yale Law School, as if my distinguishing feature was ex-con, right? But I talked to a mental health professional for 10 minutes before they excused me from the office because I challenged the fact that they waited 6 years to talk to me. And I asked what trauma he think I might have experienced over that 6 years and why it was only at this moment that he found a need to call me into his office. And so he refused to engage with me. So the truth is that I had no mental health treatment while I was incarcerated. And I wasn't on a path of recidivism, and I wasn't on a path of reoffending. I was actually on a path that men in prison helped put me on and that I helped put myself on, in a sense that, you know, I decided that I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in prison. And I looked around and I saw a lot of people who were going to spend the rest of their lives in prison. And I had some resources that other people didn't have. And I was able to take advantage of those resources with the support systems that I was able to build. But I'm still really reluctant to act as if just because you got this body of people that are incarcerated, that they are somehow like headed for future violence, more violence, or a life of crime. I think the point is that we put measures on them afterwards. We make it more difficult to get a job. We make it more difficult to get housing. We make it more difficult to get an education. And that those things help exacerbate already the profound trauma that folks have already experienced. I mean, I've had 4 tuition scholarships taken from me from Howard University. You know, I've had all kinds of things happen post-incarceration that have made my success unlikely. And those are things that have been beyond my control. And that's even worse when you get labeled as a felon and you're only 16 years old. And it gets worse when you get the stigma that comes with having a juvenile conviction. Because even though people don't know about it, a lot of people in schools and a lot of the systems that these young people deal with do know that they've been incarcerated. If you are in the 7th grade and you miss 2 months of school, everybody is aware that you've been locked up. Yeah. And when you go back to school, they treat you accordingly.
Yeah. Not to mention the damage done inside detention. I mean, that's, again, one of the stories that comes up in our podcast is that it's not only do you have to, if you do need help, not only do you not get it until you get inside, once inside, it is itself damaging. It is scarring to your mental and emotional health. And some people make it through that okay. Some people are strong enough to, as Duane says, figure out for themselves how to emerge from it healthy. A lot of people are made unhealthy by the experience.
Take a slice of this. Who's doing it right?
One, a lot of states have been moving towards closing some of their juvenile detention centers. And in closing some of their juvenile detention centers and decreasing the population of young people locked up in these detention centers, I think it's created space to have more programming for people who actually have challenges. I know that I've been to detention centers across the country, really, that have tried to bring more educational programming into those centers, that have tried to bring more outside guests, that have tried to work with the community more. You have more alternatives to incarceration that are being put in place across the country. I think the point, though, is that first, we're talking about a different system for every state in the country, and so it's really hard to just highlight one system. And second, the fact that I can't highlight just one place and say this is the model is the other challenge, because we could highlight policies that show us how we got into this situation, but we can't highlight like this is the model place to show us how we get out of it. But I will say that, you know, you got states across the country from like New York to Virginia to even here in Connecticut that have been doing some great things with young people in terms of trying to lower the rate of incarceration for juveniles. And in terms of trying to increase the program and increase the opportunities, the problem is that we haven't done enough. And the problem is that there isn't enough awareness of what is actually working.
That's contributor Dwayne Betts, poet and lawyer from Yale, and host Kai Wright of the podcast Caught. The third episode is out today. It's part of a 9-part series from WNYC Studios. Story from Alabama now, where a sheriff in one county in Alabama, stay with me now, buys a $740,000 beach house. Now, since his salary is about $93,000 a year, right away you're going to ask, where did the sheriff get that kind of money? Well, it turns out he got it from taxpayers, from funds marked to pay for inmates' food at the county lockup that sheriff runs. Well, sound like a textbook case of corruption? Maybe it is, but don't call the county prosecutor just yet, because in Alabama, that $750,000 is totally legal. The unexpectedly wealthy sheriff in this case is Todd Entrekin, and he runs the jail in Etowah County, Alabama. For the first time now, it seems like people are asking questions about the $750,000 that Entrekin pocketed and why it wasn't spent on food for inmates. Connor Sheets is a reporter for the Birmingham News and the Reckon Investigative Unit at AL.com, and he's been covering the story.
So it all started with a law from the 1930s that has not been changed. It's a state law. And some counties in Alabama have passed laws to supersede that law. But in 49 counties across the state, basically the setup is still that sheriffs are allowed to keep any money left over once they've fed all their inmates. So the reason this law exists is because back in the day, most county jails in Alabama and probably across the country were very small, at least relatively speaking, compared to now. So the sheriff would live in the same building or very close to the jail, and his wife would typically cook the food, and any, you know, small amount of money that was left over after, you know, they purchased the food and everything to go with it and fed the small number of inmates they had, that would go into the sheriff's pockets sort of as like, you know, a small bonus or tip essentially, but it was, you know, much smaller amounts of money. So what's happening now is that in Etowah County, you have a facility with hundreds of inmates, and he's getting, you know, large thousands and thousands of dollars a year to feed these inmates. And he's been able to find ways to either cut costs or do whatever to be able to not spend as much money as one might expect to feed these inmates. And in following with that same law from the 1930s, he's still able to keep whatever money he's allocated from the federal and local governments and take that home for himself.
So whatever it was in the 1930s when sheriffs and their wives were feeding inmates and keeping a couple of dollars, now we're talking about $750,000 over 3 years. And Sheriff Todd Entrekin apparently bought a beach house with some of those proceeds. How much money did he spend on feeding inmates that there were $750,000 left over?
So that part, we're not entirely clear on that. I mean, we're trying to piece that together now. We're trying to look at some of the contracts and figure that out. But he's required to report on ethics commission's forms, that he files with the state ethics commission, sort of saying how much he receives from any income source. So he, you know, he reported that he has these funds that he calls food provision funds. And he said that he received more than $250,000. That's the threshold, the highest number you have to say. So it could be up to any number, you know, conceivably, per year for each of the last 3 years through these funds. So he doesn't have to report exactly how much money he received from the governments to feed them. He just has to report how much he actually kept for himself.
And Connor, has anyone determined whether the meals being served to inmates were adequate? I mean, there was another story that another sheriff cut a deal on a truckload of corn dogs and simply fed inmates corn dogs for several weeks because he got a good deal. What are inmates eating?
Well, Entrekin actually said a couple days ago that he does split 18 wheelers of food with another local sheriff. So, you know, there has not been the level of attention to the food in the Etowah County facilities that there were in that case you were talking about. And the issue is, I mean, basically, it's very hard to get into that jail and look at those things. But there have been some studies done by, you know, nonprofits, and that, you know, they have recorded many complaints from inmates about the food. You know, it really hasn't been determined by the federal government that it's inadequate or anything like that, or the state. But there's been many years of complaints about the food there.
So Sheriff Entrekin has an incentive to cut costs because he gets to keep the excess money, and that's legal. But Connor, if there's this much excess, you know, $750,000 over 3 years. Who in the state still thinks that allocating this much money for food is a good idea?
So before this story ran, there was never an instance that anyone was aware of someone keeping that much money. I guess it had really never been reported on in this fashion. So, I mean, you know, generally you would see maybe in some of the smaller counties, someone would take home $10,000 a year, something like that. And I think some people were outraged about it, but I mean, it was something that was not seen as such an egregious thing. But now that the numbers are bigger, I think there's some conversation about, you know, doing something to address this.
Is anybody in Alabama talking about trying to change this law?
Yeah, so we're talking to lawmakers right now. There's definitely some talk about it, but we're not exactly sure if there's going to be movement on that and when and that type of thing.
Well, what has Sheriff Entrekin said for himself, and what do other sheriffs in other counties around the state have to say?
So Sheriff Entrekin maintains that he's following the law. You know, he has in the past advocated for the county commission to take over this whole issue, because at one point he was not making money off of it and was not happy with how it was being run. And so in an interview with a local news station the other day, he said, look, you know, I'm following the law. I can't do anything else other than that. So he kind of keeps reiterating that point. But some people in the state are saying, okay, it's within the law, but is it within, you know, is it moral for you to keep this much money that was allocated from taxpayers?
Connor Sheets, reporter for Birmingham News and the Reckon Investigative Unit at AL.com. Thanks.
Thank you.
More than 3 months ago, two Reuters journalists were arrested in Myanmar. We covered it back then, and since, the case has gotten some international attention. Wallon and Chasau were reporting in Rakhine State when they were picked up by state agents after meeting with local police. Now, a lot of journalists see the arrests as a government warning not to dig too deeply into the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya. I spoke with Reg Chua, chief operating officer of Reuters Editorial, who explained the charges the government is pursuing here.
Well, the government is looking to prosecute them under the Official Secrets Act, meaning that they're in possession of state secrets that, you know, will harm the country's national security. They haven't actually been charged yet. This is the interesting thing. They're in the middle of a process where the prosecution is essentially asking for the right to charge them. If they get that, then they will be charged and then we'll have a trial. So we're actually in a sort of a pre-trial, pre-charge hearing right now.
And what kind of proceedings have we been seeing here in this pre-trial phase? The government's been going about trying to show that it has evidence that these two reporters have state secrets?
That's right. This is sort of equivalent to a grand jury proceeding, if you like. The defense doesn't call witnesses. It's just the prosecution calling witnesses. They've called in police officers and so on to testify. What's interesting about the proceedings, of course, is that, you know, some of the testimony has been sort of directly contradictory of the things in the charge sheet, where they were arrested, the fact that one of the witnesses, a police officer, said he burned his notes and then reconstructed them. There's a fairly interesting set of testimony coming out.
It's a little more than 3 months since Wallon and Chasau were taken into custody. Is this process dragging on, or is this an expedited procedure?
I don't know that you'd call it expedited. We've been having hearings about once a week. But at the pace that we're going, this could be, you know, several more weeks, possibly several more months before they even determine whether there is a charge to be met here.
And you mentioned that the prosecution is calling witnesses. Your two reporters don't get to. Are they able to mount any kind of defense at this stage?
Mostly we're cross-examining the witnesses as they come in, and that's how we've been establishing some of these discrepancies in the testimony versus the charge sheet. But it's really their initiative at this point, and all we're doing is trying to point out that there really should be no charges laid here. We're very confident that the evidence shows that they didn't do anything wrong.
And Reg, have you or any of your people, your lawyers for Reuters Editorial, been able to speak with Wallon and Chasau? What are the conditions of their detention and how are they doing?
They're doing about as well as you might be expected for people who are in jail. They come once a week for those hearings. We do get to talk to them then. When the hearings last for a while, they get to have lunch with their families, which is a great thing for them, obviously. And the family and the lawyers do have visitation rights, and they have gone to see them from time to time. So they're getting some contact, but, you know, again, obviously they shouldn't be in jail to begin with.
Has there been any significant international pressure on the government in Myanmar over this case? Of course, there's a lot of attention, Reg, on the crisis with the Rohingya expelled or fled from Rakhine State. We've covered it. What about this case? Is the United States or any other government leaning on Myanmar to free these reporters or find a resolution here?
Well, we've been really gratified at the international support that this has drawn. Until recently, at least, Secretary Tillerson has spoken out about this. The United Nations Secretary General, multiple governments across Europe have raised this as an issue. Human rights groups have. It's been very clear that this is on the minds of a lot of people in the international community. Whether we're having any impact is, you know, again, a different issue.
What do you think the motivation is here behind the detention of these two reporters? Is it really about some documents they may or may not have acquired while they were reporting? Or is this about sending a message to journalists about what can happen if you report on the government?
I think, first of all, it's clear that they were not in possession of the documents as laid out, you know, in the charge. If you saw the story that the two reporters have been working on, this very deep investigation of a massacre of 10 Rohingya in the village of Indin, I think that that's very clearly one of the motivations that they did not want that story to come out.
Two Reuters reporters, Hua Lone and Cha So-woo, held more than 3 months in Myanmar. Reg Chua is chief operating officer for Reuters editorial. Reg, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. A new Yola Tango album isn't exactly a rare occurrence. The indie rock legends have 14 studio albums under their belt, but today they're back with number 15. It's called There's a Riot Going On.
Getting fuzzy. Seeing spots.
Ira Kaplan and Georgia Hubley started Yola Tango back in 1984. They added James McNew in 1992. James and Ira stopped by the studio to talk about their new album, and Ira started by explaining why There's a Riot Going On is unlike any of their previous projects.
Well, it was actually fairly different because we were halfway through the record before we knew we were working on this record. We didn't actually go into the studio per se. We just worked in our rehearsal space, which over the last bunch of years we've with James at the controls, we've done an increasing amount of recording that way, mostly film scores and other things. And we were just working on what we thought were sketches for some future studio project. And then we realized we were excited enough by the work the three of us were doing that we just kind of readjusted our sights a little and made that the record.
Let's kick this off a little bit. Let's listen to a little bit of She May, She Might from the new album. We'll talk about your process a little bit and talk about what you guys are doing in the studio.
She may, she might, to them the hope is arise.
So James, you're at the controls here when the band is riffing, coming up with new ideas, right? And this was a self-produced album. That's a first for you.
Yeah, I guess so. Produced seems extravagant. We certainly recorded it ourselves.
Now, why is produced extravagant? What does that mean?
I don't know. It to me, producing, it seems to... I feel like you have to be kind of licensed and possibly bonded and have some kind of a certificate that says that you're qualified to produce a record. But it was kind of more fun to figure things out as we were going along and actually get things to not be accidentally deleted, which I thought was a huge step forward.
You know, around the New York area, guys, and listeners around the country might not be familiar with the great radio station WFMU in New Jersey. WFMU is this fantastic freeform radio station out of New Jersey that hosts all kinds of great programming and all kinds of funny programming too. And you guys take part in their fundraisers all the time and started a tradition, I think, back in 2006 where fans would call in with instant cover requests. Let's hear one here first, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. This is the classic Route 66. Take a listen.
Oh, that's a good choice.
If you ever plan to motor west,
travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kick on Route 66.
James, can you just talk about this fantastic cover live in the studio a little bit? It's just great.
We rehearsed that for weeks and weeks and weeks, trying to find the right singer, a lot of auditions.
Sure.
Now you go to St. Louis, Joplin, Missouri, and Oklahoma City is mighty pretty, you'll see.
No, I remember, like, just almost every year, for one reason or another, tears streaming down my face, whether I'm laughing or my head is about to explode. But it's tremendous fun for us. People pledge money in exchange to be able to request just any song they can think of off the top of their heads, and we have to play it whether we know it or not.
Actually, 1996 was the first time we did it.
Oh, that's right.
And it's funny, in this, we started doing it so long ago that this computer thing really caught on in the interim. And so now there's this misapprehension in some circles that we're using the internet to help us. Like, there's so many chord sites and lyric sites that we could cheat with, but we're not. We're just trying to come back, summon up our memories of these songs, and doing the best version we can off the top of our heads with no cue cards.
Dancing across the water, Cortez, Cortez, everybody.
We're easily stumped. We don't, as anybody who's ever heard the show can attest, we don't know every song, and we don't know many of the ones we don't try. We don't know quite a few of the ones we do try. So it's really more, we hope, the shared experience of memory. I enjoy that side of it. It's like, oh God, I mean, a song will come in, you'll go, well, I remember the first line, but now what? And then the four of us hopefully can cobble together some facsimile of it, and there's no experience like it.
You've never been before.
Well, it's so much fun to listen to, and so much fun when people call in.
Oh, that was our niece. I wanted to give a shout out to our niece Leela singing Route 66. She was a frequent contributor for a few years. We did two collections of those songs. The one you played is from the first one, Yellow Tango's Murdering the Classics. But on Murder in the Second Degree, Leela comes back on two different songs. She and her friend Kelsey do a stellar version of Build Me Up Buttercup.
Why do you build me up, buttercup, baby, just to let me down, pass me around.
And then they help James out on Heya.
Well, look, you guys have been at it since, what, the mid-80s, right? 1984, is that right, together?
That's right.
Does it get hard when you've been together for so long to branch into new ground that's satisfying?
I don't feel that's something we have trouble with. I think we're all, the three of us, are very fortunate to have found each other. We do a lot of different things. We enjoy them all, and doing different things all kind of, they work with each other. I mean, while we were making this record, we did a show where we backed Robin Hitchcock playing some of his songs, and we wrote a film score for Far From the Tree. And the definition of what the band is whatever the three of us are doing at that moment, and it can be anything. And it's much more than write 12 songs, record them, go on tour.
Ira Kaplan and James McNew, thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Painting my room to reflect my mood. Facing my feelings for life without you.
You're listening to Shades of Blue there off Yola Tango's new album, There's a Riot Going On. It's out today on Matador Records.
When
That's a great way to finish out the week with Yola Tango carrying us out for the rest of the show. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.